Even before we were preparing to go, in anticipation, staff members, people who lived inside the hospital for months now, doctors have been making their way out of the region and out from the hospital after they've already evacuated other locations. Many of the physicians that I worked with and the staff had come here after working at places like Shifa and Nasser hospitals, and they expect the same to happen here now that they've lost the that sense of security of having an international presence there.
So talk about your work there, the children and others who you saw, and why you decided to leave, and also Senator Duckworth's help in this and what you were demanding, because there was a time there that you were saying you would not leave Gaza unless you knew you could be replaced.
I think what we wanted, we were asking that we wanted a safe corridor for us to leave and for us to be replaced. That was an ask that we've always made. We came with the expectation that we would leave at some point, and that other teams would come in. It was never a condition of our exit to have other people come in. It was an expectation. We did everything that we could do while we were there. We ran out of supplies. We ran out of support as more and more people were leaving. And in the end, we could only do so much without having that that replacement team come in. Our team wanted to leave together just like we came in together. When we were given the opportunity to leave as individual nations and only the Americans were given permission to leave, that was something that was unexpected. We never saw ourselves as coming in as individuals with certain passports. We came in as a team of humanitarian medical workers that are trying to help the people in Gaza. And when I stayed because I would not leave my team behind. And the same with my colleagues who stayed with me. We would not leave until we were all guaranteed that safe exit. And so when we were finally given that opportunity to go, we left, and we still ask that the international community continue to support the people. I've heard that President Biden has committed to the entry of humanitarian aid, and I would hope that as a nation we would stand by these commitments and that we would do everything that we can to replace us as soon as possible.
So, Dr. Hamawi, you wrote a letter to President Biden on May 19th, which Senator Tammy Duckworth delivered to the White House on the 20th, describing your experience and what you witnessed on the ground. In that letter, you wrote, "I have never in my career witnessed the level of atrocities and targeting of my medical colleagues as I have in Gaza." Do you know who got that letter at the White House? Have you gotten a response from the president? And if you could describe in more detail what it was that you were referencing on the ground in Gaza.
I know the letter was delivered. I don't know who. I did not receive a direct response from the president, but I know that he did receive it, and I've heard about that commitment. What I was referring to is the targeting of doctors and nurses. While I was there, one of the doctors and nurses who lived close to the hospital were killed when their house was struck, as well as their family members who were injured, killed, and wounded. I worked with doctors who had fled other hospitals, like I said. They were targeted. I've talked to doctors and nurses who were taken as prisoners, interrogated, and tortured. I know I visited other hospitals. I personally went to Nasser Hospital and saw what had happened there. I walked through the halls of an empty hospital that was vandalized, that had bloodstains on the walls and on the chairs and on the desks. That is what I'm referring to.
A new report by The Washington Post documents at least 90 cases of Israeli forces attacking hospitals in Gaza since October 7th, including an Al-Shifa hospital, Nasser hospital, and Khan Yunis. Of the 36 hospitals in Gaza attacked, tracked by the UN Humanitarian Office, only four have not been reported damaged by munitions. Can you talk about what it means to leave a hospital? What you were hearing from doctors who moved from other hospitals to where you were and then were moving on. And at the same time, this mass of humanity making their way away from Rafah as they were told to leave, though they had, that was sometimes the third and fourth relocation of their families.
I worked with a nurse that I first met when I arrived there for several days, and then I did not see him for about a week. When I saw him, I asked him where he had been, and he was relocating his family. His family lived in Rafah. They were given an evacuation order, and they went to one of the designated zones of safety, which was along the shore. Basically, a desert. It's got sand everywhere. It has no water. It has no electricity. It has no food and no shelter. They basically had bags that they carried with them, so they did not have tents to set up. His wife and his two children, he had two girls, one that is 2 years old and one that is 3 months old. He had to try to get water for them. He went to a water station where he stood for approximately 8 hours, he described to me, before he was able to fill a jug of non-drinkable water. But that is what they used to drink. And this is an example of just one family. He came back to the hospital. He looked exhausted. He looked dehydrated. He broke down and cried while I spoke to him. And he spent 2 days in the hospital, then went back to his family. And he's caught between trying to give aid because, his services are essential. A hospital cannot run on just a few doctors alone. It also needs nurses, it needs staff. And he was one of those essential staff. But he also had a family that he had to take care of. This is what one person is going through. The hospital is emptying out because many of them have done this several times. And the fear that they have is that as they leave, they're taking care of people because they see themselves as the patients. They see their families, and many of them, almost all of them, have lost someone. So when they're taking care of the patients, they're taking care of their families, they're taking care of their neighbors, and they expect to be taken care of the same way when they get hurt as well. And so they're faced with this choice that is undescribable. How do you make that decision? And when we had to leave, we were faced with this choice that is only a small, it's very small compared to what they're facing. We had to leave our patients just like they're leaving their patients. And the hope is that this would end and they could all come back, resume a life that is a small semblance of normal, be able to take care of people because that's what they do, and to be able to take care of their families as well.
Dr. Adam Hamawi, we thank you for spending this time with us. We have 10 seconds. What final message do you have as you've left Gaza and head back to New Jersey, where you work as a plastic surgeon and are an Army veteran?
Us leaving the hospital is not the end. We have to continue to try to help. There's many people left behind, and we can't leave them alone.
Dr. Adam Hamawi, we thank you so much for being with us. He's just evacuated from Gaza on Tuesday, where he'd been volunteering with the Palestinian American Medical Association at European Hospital in Khan Yunis, had been trapped on site along with other international medical workers after Israel seized the Rafah crossing between Gaza and Egypt 2 weeks ago. Next up, we speak with filmmaker Yancey Ford about his new documentary, Power, about American policing. Back in 20 seconds. You should be ashamed. Got a chain on your hands. Another man. Take off your badge. By SALT. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Ahead of Memorial Day weekend here in the United States, many are remembering how it was 4 years ago this Saturday that the police murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis sparked global protests for police accountability and abolition. This comes amidst new attention on police brutality at protests calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. Now, a new Netflix documentary called Power examines the role of police in the United States. This is the trailer.
Police power is immediate power. It's right now. Do what I told you to do right now, or else I decide what happens next.
Policing is inextricably linked to the racial history of this country.
Police associated with colonizers, wealth, and whiteness.
So police targeted people marked as non-white.
Slaves,
indigenous, and working class people.
Police have been able to double down on their power time and time again.
There are a lot of people that feel that policing is out of control. But it's also the case that there's horrific crime, and it also is out of control.
Policing is hard now. It's real hard. We deal with a lot of murders.
In the United States, police power is essentially unregulated.
Anybody who moves to hold police accountable faces a challenge.
The biggest problem with policing today is that most of the harm that policing causes is perfectly legal.
Up, hon. Get up.
How did we get here? The question breaks down as soon as you ask it. We may share this country, but is your America and my America the same place as it ever been?
Frederick Douglass said, power concedes nothing without a demand. And the power that is American policing hasn't conceded anything.
In this kind of democracy, who is more powerful? The people or the police?
The trailer for Power, now streaming on Netflix, made by Yancey Ford, director of the Oscar-nominated documentary Strong Island, about the murder of his brother. This is a clip from Power when we hear from Yancey Ford himself.
Police power is enormous, omnipotent, and hard to pin down. It is the might of 1 million police wielded everywhere. All at once. Police power is extraordinarily intimate. The same massive institution can search your pockets, trace your cell phone, demand your identification, watch you with surveillance cameras, or collect your DNA. In the United States, police power is essentially unregulated. In this kind of democracy, who is more powerful? The people or the police?
For more, we're joined by Yancey Ford, director of this new documentary, Power. Welcome back to Democracy Now, and congratulations.
Thank you, Amy. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you with us. Talk about when you started this film.
Yeah, so, you know, I started developing the film in the aftermath of the murder of George Floyd. And in response, directly in response to the policing of the protests that broke out around the country in response to his murder, there was something about the tenor of the police protests, the unrestrained violence the response of the police to the protests, the unrestrained violence of the police response to these protests. I was watching people getting chased onto highways. I was watching people being run over by cars, being kettled, indiscriminately on the streets. And it led me to ask this question, is this what policing is really for? And that, you know, began this process, this three-year process that eventually turned into this film.
So let me turn to another clip. And I hate to interrupt you, but it is your documentary. Yeah. And the power of this documentary is just astounding. And the scope and historical breadth. This is New York University professor Nikhil Pal Singh, author of Race in America's Long War, making a central point in Power.
So we go back to what we've been talking about all along. We have these three dimensions of the American political project. The one that flows out of slavery and the capture and coercion of black labor. One that grows out of the frontier and the expansion and land hunger and conquest of indigenous people. And one that grows out of the development of American capitalism and its demand for labor. It always begins from these sets of relationships to property. It always begins from the idea that people without property, or people who are property, in the case of enslaved people, are a threat to the social order built on property.
That's NYU professor Nikhil Pal Singh. Yancey Ford, talk about these three dimensions.
Yeah, you know, these three points of origin of policing, and the argument that the film makes is that, you know, if we take a step back and realize that policing was never organized around fighting crime and keeping people safe, right? Police was always organized about the control, regulation, or seizing of property, whether it's people, indigenous land in the West, or breaking unions and regulating the, you know, behavior of not yet white immigrants in northeastern cities. It helps you understand, when you reframe policing in that way, what we see when people like Eric Adams in New York City says, we're not going to let people destroy our city. And the destruction that he's talking about isn't necessarily actual property destruction, right? The destruction that he's talking about is this semblance of order, and order as defined by the police, order as defined by politicians who are not interested in dissent being expressed freely by people on the streets of any city in the United States. You see that in the response to Cop City in Atlanta. You see that in response to the Freddie Gray protests. You see that in response to, you know, the protests after the murder of Michael Brown. The thing that the police want to do more than anything else is contain and control threats to order. And these threats to order are almost always about keeping property safe from the expression of anger and frustration on the part of the people.
I'm wondering if you can talk about a key figure in U.S. police history, August Vollmer, who you go into in power.
Yeah. August Vollmer is deployed to the Philippines after the Spanish-American War and the United States occupation of the Philippines after the Spanish-American War. And he's part of this specialized unit that's charged with going into the interior of the country to root out the resistance to the American occupation, to crush that resistance and to take over that land. And what August Vollmer learns while he's away are the strategies of war and the strategies of occupation, the strategies of you know, counterinsurgency, as you will. And when he returns to the United States from the Philippines, he brings that counterinsurgency mindset with him, and he becomes the police chief in Berkeley, California. And quickly, you know, the mindset of counterinsurgency, right, seeing people who might be criminals as threats to the national order, seeing people who might be, expressing, dissent as existential threats to the country. That's directly from his experience in the Philippines. Hmm. And so when we come to understand by watching this film how much of our domestic policing was actually influenced by this feedback loop of American occupation overseas, then it's not a surprise then when you see, you know, equipment, personnel carriers that look like they are straight from the battlefield. It's because they are straight from the battlefield. They are, you know, military equipment that's, you know, given to, granted to, or sold to police departments around the country to specifically enact the use of police as, you know, frankly, small militaries whose job it is to suppress dissent.
I want to go back to Power, your documentary about the role of police and property, where we hear from Charlie Adams, a Minneapolis police inspector in a precinct near where George Floyd was killed by police in 2020.
Our police department, law enforcement, is a paramilitary organization, right? And people don't realize why it became a paramilitary organization. It's because police came from the slave patrol.
Up, 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 hon, get up.
All these enslaved folks are walking in town. If they don't have a note from master, they end up getting beat severely. And the masters are just fed up with these slave patrols, right? So they asked the Citadel, can you train these people? Give them some type of structure. Well, guess what the structure is? Paramilitary.
Where do you live, Foot?
Put your hand down.
Where?
Go there.
I think if our officers understood that and had that conversation and was taught that, I think they'll know why when somebody African American says, yeah, you're a product of slave patrols, but he would understand what they meant by that, right? You know, because some words like patrolling, you know, we haven't changed that, right? We talked about getting a letter going into town from master, right? What do cops do when they see a group of black males standing? Hey, let me see your ID.
So talk about what Minneapolis Police Inspector Charlie Adams is saying. He was in the precinct right next to the precinct where George Floyd was murdered. And then I want to talk about that murder and what you did in the film with the blind spot, who you chose to focus on in the murder of George Floyd.
So, you know, Inspector Adams is really, I think, unique among, the active duty police officers that we considered talking to. Charlie Adams is aware of the history of policing and how it originates in part from slave patrols. And he understands that that history informs the way in which police officers see communities of color, particularly in the 4th Precinct in Minneapolis, where he is, you know, sort of charged with trying to keep the neighborhood he is from safe. But he also recognizes that the training police have received is from a military model. When he calls it paramilitary, you might as well just drop the para part. There's nothing paramilitary about it. It is military. And I think that what he, you know, tries to impress upon his officers by taking them to the Legacy Museum in Montgomery, Alabama, for example, is the complicity of police in some of our greatest atrocities in this nation. Right? He talks about how police were complicit in the rash of lynchings that swept the country during Jim Crow and you know, post-Reconstruction. And I think that, you know, what he's trying to do where he is also, you know, confined by the agenda of the institution in which he works, right? Like, he's only able to do so much. Yes, he can teach his officers about the origins of policing, but at the end of the day, you know, the Minneapolis Police Department wants to put kids in a pipeline that will lead to incarceration. And we see a scene in the film where he talks to community activists about keeping those kids out of that pipeline, but he doesn't actually have any other option for them.
And talk about what you did with the footage of the murder of George Floyd by the police, the blind spot.
Yeah, so what we did, you know, we took that footage, we show a very small, you know, a very small amount of it at the beginning so that we know where we are in time. And then we blot out everything except Officer Tao and the two people who are confronting him during George Floyd's murder, so that all you see are these three people. It's like a little triangle. And what's happening in that dynamic is that you have two people who are insisting that Officer Tao simply check George Floyd's pulse. And what does he do? He tells them not to do drugs. What does he do? He tells them to get back on the sidewalk. What does he say? I'm not going to have this conversation now. By blotting out the rest of the scene and highlighting that interaction, what we do is raise the issue of complicity and the fact that Officer Tao is as complicit in the murder of George Floyd as Derek Chauvin, because he allowed it to happen within feet of him when he's being told by people to simply check the pulse of a man who had yet to move and who didn't appear to be breathing. He refused to do that. He refused to intervene, and as a result of his, you know, complicity, as well as the complicity of other officers who were there, lost his life. That scene could have ended it could have ended differently. But none of them were able to gin up the courage to say stop to Derek Chauvin.
Finally, we just have a minute, but this is the fourth anniversary of the murder of George Floyd by police. It's also this season of violent police crackdowns on the Gaza encampments.
Mm-hmm. So what we see in the crackdown on these encampments, what we see in the crackdown on, you know, of unrest on the streets here and in other places is simply the logical outcome of the origins of our police. They were always formed with the idea that violence to contain and control a disorderly public is at the heart of policing's function in this country. And so when we see, you know, the most professional police department in the world, the NYPD, swinging clubs and swinging fists and throwing people to the ground as a way of breaking up or policing, a demonstration. It's that violence is part and parcel of what they are taught.
What are you calling for?
I'm calling for people to watch this film, to understand our history, and to decide for themselves what demand they are going to make of police. We all have a responsibility to decide what we are going to demand of the politicians whose job it is to regulate police, but also what we are going to demand of policing itself. And in my opinion, that demand is that police take a step back out of the leadership position that they insist on putting themselves
in
and listen to the communities that they are supposedly supposed to serve and arrive at a different definition of public safety driven by communities, not by police.
Yancey Ford, Oscar-nominated director of the new documentary Power, which is on Netflix. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
If you're a Canadian Indigenous student considering many life choices about your future, Inspire can help. If you need ideas about possible education or career path options specifically for First Nations, Métis, and Inuit folks like you, join Inspire's mentorship program, Rivers to Success. It's free to register, and you'll get plenty of up-to-the-minute information about university, college, and vocational trade schools. Most importantly, again, it's free. It's free, it's free, it's free. It's online and we have monthly events with prizes. Discover the many potential job and study opportunities that are waiting for you across Turtle Island. Register online now at rivers2success.ca. Again, that's rivers2success.ca.